Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Salt City Hoops podcast. We're very excited to be starting this from a new location from the ESPN 700 studios. We just signed a fantastic deal with them, and I'm so excited to be working with Bill Riley and the team on creating some awesome Utah Jazz content for you guys with Salt City Hoops writers and along with different personalities, jazz personalities, writers from NBA sites, etc., around the internet. We're pretty excited for what this can be. So anyway, my name is Andy Larson. I'm the managing editor for Salt City Hoops. I'm here along with Ben Dowsett, the, I don't know, associate writer, person, extraordinaire, analyst.
As long as extraordinaire is in there, I'm cool with it.
Good. So yeah, I think Ben's awesome. I welcome you guys to check out all of our work on saltcityhoops.com. We are the ESPN True Hoop affiliate for the Utah Jazz, so we're on the cover beat daily, tracking all the stories, tracking this coaching search, tracking the draft pick for the Utah Jazz. And actually, Ben, that's what I want to talk to you about first today. Is last week the Jazz did pick up that number five pick in the lottery, and you were working with Lane Vashro, who's kind of well renowned on the internet for having these great draft projection models. Right.
Yeah.
So the basic idea, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that he's using their college stats along with their measurements in order to kind of predict what these players are going to do in the future.
That's a really general way of putting it. Essentially, he's using a number of box score measurements, some basic and then some a little bit more advanced, things like strength of schedule and margin of victory as well from college. There's a coach aspect as well. And all these variables, I won't go too into it for our non-mathematically inclined listeners, but essentially he's putting all of these factors into a regression analysis, and he's doing so over the past 30 seasons worth of college basketball, and what results is projected value for each type of statistic. So he can essentially weigh how important variables are moving from college to the NBA, and he can then plug those same variables in for the current draft class and project what his, and of course these are 100% objective models. They are not, he has one model that's the Humble model, which does incorporate an element of popular scouting consensus in, but that would be the only subjective area of the models that you would find. The rest is all historically based data showing what typically over time has been the most successful areas for players leaving from college to the NBA.
Okay, so you're saying there are two different models. There's this, the Humble model, which kind of takes into account the scouting reports, the mock drafts from around the internet, if I understand correctly.
Yeah.
And then there are these ones that don't, right? Just straight up the math, the stats from their college translated into the NBA.
Exactly.
So that's cool. What are the conclusions, I guess? So if you're Dennis Lindsay right now, you're picking number five, you're looking at Lane's data, you're looking at your own scouting work, there are a bunch of different possibilities at number five, obviously. What could the Jazz do? I mean, who would you take, first of all? Let's start there.
Well, just to preface this a little bit, I should note that Lane's measurements are based so heavily on college statistics, and to try and standardize with international statistics would be extremely difficult to near impossible. Lane's models don't, in fact, track international players, so you couldn't just go directly by his models.
So we can't have Kristaps Porzingis?
We can't have Kristaps
Porzingis. We need Kristaps Porzingis.
I know, it's sad, right? Saric or obviously Dante Exum. In the top five would not be somebody who's in Lane's models. If you go to my personal opinions, I believe in a vacuum, and again, if we're assuming that those consensus top four guys in Parker, Wiggins, Embiid, and Exum do come off the board with the first four picks, and that nobody wants to trade with the Jazz, which we may discuss in a little. In a vacuum, I believe that the fifth best prospect in this draft is Noah Vonleh. I did a piece on him last week on Salt City Hoops, profiling him. His upside is extremely high in nearly every area. He's got a freakish wingspan for his size, the longest height to wingspan difference in the draft combine this year, mistaken. Extremely, I believe 7'4 is the wingspan. He's extremely capable already as a field player offensively. He can shoot the ball extremely well from distance. He shot some, I don't remember off the top of my head, but some ridiculous percentage last year from three, which probably isn't sustainable over time, but still the fact that he's shooting 40-plus percent on over one attempt per game is definitely quite impressive. He's got a solid post game. He can work from either side of the block. He may have some issues in the NBA. There's some questions. And to me, in terms of the Jazz's situation, a lot is going to depend contextually on how they view some of the pieces they have already. Particularly Enes Kanter. The Jazz do have a decision to make with Kanter over this summer, whether they choose to extend him now or allow him to enter restricted free agency next year. You go ahead.
No, let me ask. Do you think Noah Vonleh or Enes Kanter is a better prospect? Because really, that's what Dennis Lindsay's got to answer the next month.
Yeah, and essentially that's going to hinge their decision right there, I would think. It's a really hard question to answer.
Because Vonleh, is one of the best things about him is that he can shoot from that outside mm-hmm. distance, right? Yeah. But Kanter kind of can as well. I mean, he hasn't shown the three-point ability like that Vonleh kind of has, although mm-hmm. Vonleh hasn't done it in very many attempts. But when I watch practice and I watch Enes Kanter warm up before all the games, he's taking those three-point jump shots.
He can hit him, I'm
so
sure.
We know that he can hit him. Maybe not at the rate where you want to like release a weapon in games yet, but he's clearly at least developing that three-point shot.
Yeah.
So to me, I guess, I would need Noah Vonleh to be a significantly better prospect than Enes Kanter is.
Yeah, and I think that's, obviously that's going to be a decision for Dennis and the rest of the front office. That it's going to be a difficult one if it comes to that point where they're making the fifth pick with those options on the board. I do think the ceiling for Vonleh defensively, at least the ceiling, is a lot higher than Kanter's. I think his wingspan is one of the main reasons for that. He's able to utilize that. He had a high steal and a high block rate in college, both of which, going back to Lane's models, both of those tend to pan out very well in the NBA. Those statistics, both, they tend to carry over very well.
So I know Lane has these comps, right, these player comparables. Uh-huh. Who are some for Noah Vonleh? And I guess, on a related note, what are some of his downsides that mean that he's not one of those top four tier picks?
The biggest downside to me that I also wrote in the piece was that his basketball IQ is fairly low. I would say on the lower end for this year's draft class. He's not, especially defensively, he's not particularly adept at picking up help rotations.
So he is Enes Kanter. Enes Kanter,
that's
right?
That's the thing, is the physical ceiling defensively is a lot higher.
Okay.
His big reach, there was some debate in the comments section of my article, which I won't go too far into, but over Vonleh's athleticism and his leaping ability. It depends who you ask there, I guess, but he is a little bit slow getting off the floor. He had a good vertical number at the combine, but those who pay attention know that those numbers can be deceiving, and that's why they're not generally taken into too high a stock. If he can correct, you never know whether this might be something, he had bad coaching in high school. He only went to 1 year of university, and frankly, Indiana was pretty bad this year. It could just be things like that, or it could be that maybe he's a little bit of a slower learning player, and that he doesn't, he may be like something like a Kanter where he has certain issues grasping the defensive system. But if, and we know it's an if he can find some of those things and make some of those things work, his defensive ceiling is a ton higher than Kanter's, the wingspan being the main reason. He's, as a post defender especially, he's going to be a big upgrade.
So I guess my question is, and I'm watching the film that's in your article and watching film on Draft Express and other sites, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a guy who's been this questionable on the basketball IQ side? Like, he makes the wrong decision in terms of where to pass the ball, who to rotate to. He's one of the youngest prospects.
Youngest prospect. Yeah, he doesn't turn 19 till August.
Yeah, so that's insane, and maybe I should give him more benefit of the doubt than that, but I just think that maybe, is there a guy who has this low of basketball IQ that's then been able to markedly improve that in the NBA? Or is he just going to be kind of this out-of-system player in the NBA, too?
That's a good question, and off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of players at a similar position. Bosch is the comp that gets used most regularly, and I think Bosch was certainly a level or two higher in terms of his basketball IQ at this point. Boy, that's a good question. You flummoxed me a little bit there,
yes,
Andy.
Good.
That's a good
Finally.
One.
I just wanted to stump you.
Come back to me there. I'm thinking about it as we continue here. Come back to me on it.
Okay, cool. So I actually do want to continue later on in the show as we kind of break down these other prospects for the Jazz, possibly at the number 5 pick, like the Aaron Gordons, the Marcus Smarts. Julius Randle is another option for the Jazz. But right now on the line, we've got Denim Millward, one of our writers from Salt City Hoops. Denim, are you there?
I am here. Can you guys hear me?
We can. Cool. So I wanted to know, you wrote an article this Monday about how the Jazz can become a better team right away, right? So we're talking about guys like Noah Vonleh, and he's a prospect who, you know, is a long, long ways away from really being able to contribute at a high level in the NBA. He doesn't have the basketball IQ. He's only 18 years old. But I don't know if Jazz fans can take several more seasons of losing like we just had in 2013-2014. So you wrote in your article there may be a path for like an accelerated rebuild. And in particular, you know, we may be able to make some moves and make some trades in order to do that. Can you tell me more about what you kind of envision in this accelerated rebuild scenario?
Sure. So this all came about based on some comments that Dennis Lindsay made a little while ago, basically saying that he would like to accelerate that if possible. I think we're bored with that, you know, as a fan and even as someone who covers the team, it's not much fun to see them, you know, piling up loss after loss. And so basically what I tried to envision is if we did want to kind of put the pedal to the metal, so to speak, on getting back into the playoffs and getting back into being a winning team, essentially how that desire would manifest itself in off-season transactions. So basically I looked at it from the standpoint of how it would affect the draft primarily, how would it affect the so-called core four or five or whatever cliche term you want to use to describe our young guys, and then how it could manifest itself in either keeping or trading the picks.
Okay, so let's break those down. So first of all, if you wanted to do this accelerated rebuild, and let's say you keep the pick, first of all, would that affect who you draft? Would you want to take a more NBA-ready player right away?
So I think it certainly could. Now, I want to be careful. I don't want to overstate it. If the Jazz, if they can't make a move, they're sitting at five, and despite his you know, the long-term development process that it would take to get someone like Noah Vonleh ready to contribute and to possibly be a potential franchise player, if the Jazz believe in both him and their coaching staff, and they believe that even though it would take a little bit longer, that he would be the guy, I don't think that wanting to win now would necessarily preclude them from taking a guy like Vonleh. However, if there are two people, let's say they're sitting at five, they weren't able to make any moves, and they're deciding between someone like Julius Randle and Noah Vonleh. Someone like Julius Randle, yes, he's young and he still has plenty of developing to do, but he has a very refined offensive skill set, and he could definitely make an impact and produce immediately. And so if it's a coin flip, I could definitely see the how immediately ready they are to contribute being the deciding factor between a player who maybe has a little bit lower of a ceiling but is ready to contribute now versus a player like Vonleh who, you know, is going to take a few years to develop.
Okay, so cool. No, so we know, you know, if we did keep the pick, then that's kind of an option. I agree. I think Julius Randle would make more sense in that scenario than Noah Vonleh would. But let's say, the pick makes more sense to be traded. Then what happens? I mean, is there a spot for that pick to be traded to? You mentioned some maybe veteran guys who the Jazz could bring in right away and add a few wins. How could this happen?
Well, there are a few options, and obviously, landing a franchise player is not an easy thing to do. Of course, Dennis Lindsay and the Jazz organization in recent years have proven that they're not afraid to roll the dice and make big splashy trades. Of course, with Deron Williams, we were kind of at the opposite end of that. So we have two first round picks this year. We have cap space. We obviously have a good complement of young players who should be desirable in a trade scenario for several teams. So, of course, the primary player, if we're looking for a veteran and we're looking to trade the pick for a veteran, primary player that is supposedly available right now is Kevin Love. Now, is it likely that Love would decide to come here and sign an extension? Probably not. With his UCLA ties and his ties to California, a lot of people think it's a foregone conclusion that he just wants to go to the Lakers. There's also going to be other suitors for him, of course, who may either have better or different assets that are more palatable to the Timberwolves, or are destinations where Love would agree to sign an extension. So that would be a long shot. Honestly, for any veteran that we're going to get, it's going to take probably a combination of giving up a significant portion of our assets, as well as possibly an overpayment either in trade assets or eventually in signing that player to an extension. Unfortunately, we're all too aware of the playing in a small market in a destination that's not quite as desirable for free agents. So,
right. But that being said, if you make a trade, then they don't really have a choice to some extent, right? You know, if you get traded from Brooklyn or Boston, as some of your examples say, then they have to play for the Jazz at least for the next season. Go ahead.
Right. That is very true. The problem you could run into there, though, is let's say they can look at someone who, if their contract's expiring soon, you know, if it's someone that's locked into a contract for 3 or more years, something like that, then yes, it's definitely a possibility. And really, if we're going to land a franchise player that's ready to play right now and to contribute, and that player's not going to come from the draft, then that's certainly more than likely how we would have to do it. However, you are really, for example, in the Love scenario, you're really kind of taking a huge gamble. If you're going to trade young assets who you have locked up for a number of years that are, you know, making not a whole lot of money yet, if you're going to trade that for someone who could walk after a season or two of contributing, then you know, that's definitely a huge risk that we would have to think long and hard about taking.
So let me ask you, if you know, you mentioned in your article the possibility of trading for, say, Brook Lopez, from Brooklyn.
That was the one that was intriguing to me.
Okay, so, and I agree. I think, you know, he does have that max deal, but he's shown an ability, especially early in the season before he got injured, to be an impact center, score at an efficient level, defend pretty well.
He was protecting the rim really well before he got injured.
So, I mean, that's exactly the kind of guy who the Jazz need after being ranked 30th defensively. The Jazz could give up some assets. I guess my next question is, how good does that make you? You know, let's say you take Brook Lopez, and let's say you take Julius Randle, and you put all these pieces together and sign a good bench in free agency. How many more wins does that add to the Jazz? Can they get to the playoffs?
I think it could put them close. Of course, there's a lot of other factors to consider. Who are we going to hire as a coach? What is our offensive and defensive philosophies and schemes? What are they going to look like? And so I think it depends on how well the pieces fit. Of course, luck plays a huge factor, and how, you know, if we do deal for someone like Lopez, and how lucky are we going to be with his health or the health of any of our existing players. I definitely think that could get us close, even in the ultra-competitive West. I think that certainly could put us in contention. The benefit also would be that we wouldn't be, presuming that we still have the most, say, 2 to 3 or even 4 of our core players in place still, and then we add someone like Lopez and you know, someone through the draft like Julius Randle, for say. In that scenario, getting either an 8 seed and getting bounced in the first round, or, you know, even coming close to the playoffs but not making it, is a lot more palatable than doing so with a lot older team, because you're obviously, things are still looking up, you're still on the upward slope, you can still see that tangible progression that you can measure. You can say, hey, we're getting better, even though we didn't quite meet our goal this year, or, yeah, we got to the playoffs and then, you know, San Antonio smoked us in 4 games. That's still going to be some progression, and you're going to be doing that with a young team who's only going to presumably grow together and all get better.
Well, the only other potential issue with Lopez that I'll note is he's in the same situation as a Love-type player, where this is the final guaranteed year on his contract. He does, like Kevin Love, he does have a player option for the following year, which you'd likely want to see him exercise before you'd make any sort of trade for him, so you know that you're getting 2 years out of a player. And it is at a fairly high cap number, but so that is, I do think the Jazz would want to be careful with that. You don't, it's hard to say whether
a
guy.
But the Jazz do have cap space.
Oh, they have a ton. Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. They definitely have a ton. My main, the point I was getting to there was that I don't know. Certainly the whichever asset it was that decided that was to be moved for him, the Jazz would want to be pretty sure that they were really getting a benefit there, because, you know, like, I wouldn't want to be sending Alec Burks off with a chance that I might only get a year or two of a good center who's often injured. Context plays into everything, of course, but that's just something the Jazz will need to be careful with if they look into something like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, go ahead, Denham.
The interesting thing with Lopez, and the reason I mention it, is because Brooklyn has been mentioned in rumors as possibly being willing to deal Deron Williams. Now, of course, we all know that they have a gigantic luxury tax payment coming up, and that they're way over the cap, so they're really hamstrung with their flexibilities and what they can do. So the reason that Lopez is so interesting to me is that they're obviously willing to do some wheeling and dealing. They want to. They realize that their window is slamming shut very quickly, and so that could be a potential situation where we could, in exchange for Lopez, provide some of the trade assets that they would desire to get another player on their team to make, you know, one final run at a championship. And they're definitely in win now mode, and so because they're so desperate for a title, and as well to capitalize on their very short or their very rapidly closing window, that we might be able to net Lopez for somewhat less than a team who has a lot less incentive and desperation, for lack of a better term, to make a deal right now and to really try to strike while the iron is hot.
Well, thank you, Denham, for joining us. Go ahead and check out his article. This it was published on Tuesday regarding making an accelerated rebuild. Could the Jazz be winners next season? Denham, again, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
So here's my math with that possibility of an accelerated rebuild. I think if you traded for someone like Brook Lopez, you know, 7 to 8 win sort of player, you sign a bench that's above replacement level, unlike the Jazz bench last season, which was not above replacement level, right? We had guys Garrett and, you know, even guys like Richard Jefferson, who are really just replacement level players. Right?
Yeah.
You could sign a few
above,
good,
maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you could sign good bench guys and get a good draft pick. Let's say he's worth 5 wins. Say your bench is worth 5 wins altogether. Let's say you get a coach that's worth, I don't know, 3 to 4 wins above Ty Corbin's. Again, I think probably at that replacement level kind of head coaching spot. And all of a sudden, you've added 20 wins to the team, right? So you go from 25 to 45. Maybe you get some improvement from Derek Favors, Alec Burks, Trey Burke, Enes Kanter, whatever. I mean, sure, you may have to trade some of those guys away. Maybe Gordon Hayward takes another leap after having a year under his belt as the man. I just think it's possible that the Jazz could make the playoffs if they do choose to do this. Now, yeah, they do have to give up assets, but I think it makes the team a lot better for next season.
Definitely, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. I would maybe be 50-50 on it if in a specific Lopez type scenario. I would generally assume that Kanter would probably be a piece moving out if they were attempting to do that deal. When Lopez was first discussed as like even a rumored possibility, I remember somebody bringing up Kanter as a potential piece in a move like that. Yeah, I would think that there would maybe need to be a little bit of improvement of a leap from a couple of the other younger guys already on the roster, but that's certainly far from impossible. I'm going to have a piece on Favors coming out here soon on how I think he can take some steps this year, and took some steps this past year, but can take some further ones this year to be even better than he was. And of course, the other area of this that we didn't really discuss as much with Denham, but that I think is going to be potentially very important, is there are some free agents out there who the Jazz could be looking at. One who I'm thinking of specifically is a guy like a Spencer Hawes. Spencer Hawes is an unrestricted this year. You know, there's a chance Cleveland tries to keep him, but what if Cleveland decides they want to draft Embiid first and they're getting their center for the future? They don't want Spencer Hawes back. Spencer Hawes is not a top tier free agent. He's a second to third tier guy, capable center. He can shoot the ball. He may not be the best guy for improving our defensive culture necessarily, but he's not the worst in the NBA.
No, but again, and then I think he improves your bench over.
Uh-huh. Absolutely, and that's something where you don't have to spend an asset to go ahead and grab him. There's several of these sort of mid-tier free agent guys, not necessarily always at the center. That, you know, there might be a Josh McRoberts. He does have a player option, though, so I kind of doubt he's going anywhere. I bet he's probably sticking around.
Honestly, I think wing is where the Jazz need more help than power forward and center. Maybe I just believe in Rudy Gobert too much, but I think he's an impact player defensively, and then you have Derek Favors, Enes Kanter, and, you know, maybe one of these bigs in the draft who the Jazz could take.
Yeah.
To me, I think that's the position of need in the free agent market.
Yeah, and there's some of those types of guys, too. I mean, he may end up being a little overpriced, but a Trevor Ariza type is going to be on the market. I mean, he may, after the playoffs he had this year, he may be looking for a little bit more glamour in terms of where he goes. You never know. You don't know what a guy is thinking. Avery Bradley's restricted over in Boston. Jazz have some cap room. If they're going to throw some money at one of our restricteds, let's throw some money at one of their restricteds. what's the difference? Sean Marion is unrestricted out of Dallas. I have a feeling they'll try and re-sign him, but you never know. That would be, Sean Livingston is unrestricted out of Brooklyn. There's, you know, Nick Young. I don't like Nick Young, but he's
backup point guard, though, too, is another spot where the Jazz could have a big improvement. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all loved what Deonte Garrett did after coming in after the first six or seven games and being an improvement on John Lucas and Jamal Tinsley, but that being said, he wasn't good.
I mean that's like being an improvement on me.
Like, yeah, he threw up, I think, a 7.7 PER last season. Like, these are not great numbers from Deonte Garrett. You can get Deonte Garrett anywhere, and I like Deonte Garrett. It's hard for me to say that, but, you know, Sean Livingston would be a huge improvement.
Oh, absolutely. He'd be, although I worry that he might be another one of those guys whose value may have been slightly inflated from the way he played this postseason, and he may look for a starting job, like a full-time starting job somewhere. That type of thing is hard to say without, you know, knowing more about a player's personality and their own particular stuff. You know, even Vince Carter is a free agent if we wanted a little bit of a veteran presence or something.
I just like imagining Vince Carter in Utah. I think we need more guys from that era of the Nets that we can have on our roster
assist
to just shoot threes and kind of dunk sometimes.
Oh, he still dunks everyone.
Does Richard Jefferson.
It's true. Vince and Richard they break out like two or three ridiculous highlight dunks a year. Like,
we need to trade for Jason Kidd. And Brooke Lopez, too, of course. And then who else was on that roster? Can we get Kerry Kittle somehow? Like, I want this entire Nets.
Well, Dre Blatch, obviously.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to be getting...
If we're going with the Nets theme.
Darren Williams, we won't say yes to. Darren can come back.
And to briefly speak to Denham's point about Darren and then and Brooklyn looking to potentially be on the market to trade him, there is no way, unless Amari Stoudemire is involved coming back. Like, there's, I don't know, that I have to think that might is one of the three or four most untradeable contracts in the league currently.
Yeah, that'd be rough. Okay, so we were talking about before we were talking about Denham or talking to Denham, we were talking about the possibilities at number five, and we mentioned in our phone call with Denham the possibility of drafting Julius Randle. So I kind of wanted to get like a quick scouting report on him, what you think and what really Lane's numbers think as far as will he make sense moving forward into the NBA. Do his college statistics translate to NBA performance?
Both Lane's and my own personal opinion, well, I don't want to call Lane's opinions because they are, as we said, objective.
Numbers, yeah.
Exactly. But, and then my opinion as well, they do not favor Randle as much as some others might. Lane's model, his EWP model, which is his base model, that's the singular objective one, and then the one that combines into scouting consensus is called Humble, and it combines the EWP model with scouting consensus. So his EWP model, which is estimated wins peak, which it estimates a player's wins peak added by before their 26th birthday in the NBA. Julius Randle is 12th on that list currently. If you look at the Humble rankings, he does move up just a little bit because obviously the popular consensus has him a little higher. So he's up to 7th in the Humble rankings, which is probably right around where people generally have him. The biggest concern I have with Randle is going to be his ability to finish over NBA length and to defend NBA length. He had some pretty short measurements at the combine. Again, we're not putting too much stock in that sort of thing, but he kind of lacks a little bit of lift off the ground. He's certainly not going to be the most vertical player, and we're seeing more and more with the length in the NBA. If you can't finish over that, especially as a big guy who does the majority of his operating down low, that could be a big potential red flag.
So he's got his comps for Julius Randle as, and I kind of like these comps, so that's why I bring him up. Leon Powell, which is kind of a rude comp. But it's not particularly flattering for Randle. But J.J. Hickson, Thomas Robinson, Derek Williams, and Larry Kostowiak, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
The Utah tie. I just think that that's probably what he is in the NBA, is someone like those guys who's maybe a bench big rather than a all-star level big. I mean, mm-hmm. people make the comparison to Zach Randolph. I just don't think that he has that game.
No. The difference in their wingspan and their length is, what is it, like 4.5 inches or something mm-hmm. like that I saw yesterday that I don't love. I mean, people who read my draft articles know that I dislike the general idea of just comparing players based on the fact that they look similar and probably have similar complexion and maybe have like similar looking games. I'm really not too big into that in general, and that's one of those the whole Julius Randle to Zach Randolph is exactly one of those. They're going to have some similarities. They're both low post players, like, cool, but they're not the same player. They're not going to be the same player.
Meanwhile, like, on the other end of the spectrum in terms of that is Julius Randle compared to Larry Kostkowiak.
I should note real briefly that Lane's comparables are, again, an objective. They're the smallest average standard deviations across all of the variables included in his general models. So it doesn't even he isn't making these comparisons based on a playing style or based on a frequency of a certain type of player or anything like that. He's basing them only on exact value contributed in their college seasons. So it's interesting from that perspective.
Cool. Okay, so we do have Jacob Frankel on the phone, and I do want to talk to him. Jacob is a writer for ESPN's Hickory High website as well as ESPN True Hoop. Jacob, are you there?
Yep. What's going on, guys?
So Jacob was kind enough to join us from Hawaii, and I believe it's 6:30 local time there. Is that correct?
It is.
What a trooper.
I'm so deeply sorry. That's, you know, 10:30 is good for me in terms of being able to record a podcast and still be cognizant. I'm glad that you were able to join us in beautiful Hawaii.
Yeah, all sorts of weird time zone things going on with watching basketball here.
Yeah, so actually, speaking of watching basketball, I wanted to ask you about the playoffs last night before we go into anything. And I guess I want to get your idea of what the biggest difference was between games 3 and 4 and game 5. You know, Serge Ibaka didn't have any sort of influence. It was another Spurs blowout. Why are those games so different, given that, you know, it was the same 12 players on the floor for both teams?
So going into game 5, I thought the Spurs were done. I thought this was 2012, the repeat.
Me too.
But, I mean, there's some schematic stuff, obviously, where Pop didn't play, Thiago Splitter, and Tim Duncan at all together. He always had a big, they could space the floor in DR or Bonner, and that hugely helped to pull Ibaka away from the rim. And part of it is just, I mean, fatigue for the Thunder, and it's not coming out with as much energy as they did in games 3 and 4. Like, look at Ibaka, he was like 3 of 10. You probably can't remember any memorable blocks that started those Thunder fast breaks. So yeah, I think that was a large part of it. There's one schematic adjustment that Zach Lowe noted, where the Spurs were bringing more ball handlers toward where pick and rolls were being run as an outlet, because the Thunder were just swarming the pick and rolls. So they had more ball handlers there that they could easily get the ball to.
So the idea is
just
you
as
have
a safety valve.
Sorry, yeah.
But
so you
I think it was largely just the fatigue and effort.
Okay, and I think that could be the biggest thing. But I like this idea of, you know, you have these incredible athletes of the Thunder hounding these pick and rolls, so you can't get anything done off of them, even with a pick and roll artist like Tony Parker. And then so you bring someone like a Boris Diaw or a Kawhi Leonard, someone who can really pass the ball closer to those pick and rolls, so you get that safety valve and have that temporary 4-on-3 opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Pop is, oh man, I love Pop. Who else starts Matt Bonner in the Western Conference Finals?
That was brilliant. Like, averaging
that was fun.
1 point per game in these playoffs, half a rebound, number whatever his number is, Matt Bonner. Like,
yeah.
I just love that. Okay, so Jacob, the biggest reason we have you on here in Utah is just, you also have one of these draft projection models that you've worked a lot on, mostly statistical-based. But, again, these are the different models that Dennis Lindsay and company from the Jazz may be looking at in order to determine who they're going to be picking at number 5. Because and honestly, the path for the franchise as a whole in the future, because you want to figure out, you know, how many wins may be reasonable to expect from this pick. So I want to get your sense of the draft, especially looking at the number five pick.
Yeah, so it seems that the top four picks are fairly locked in. The order's still up in the air, but it's Embiid, Wiggins, Parker, and Exum. So the Jazz at five are really like the first big domino to fall in how the rest of the lottery shakes out. And it seems to be that there's going to be like four options with Randall, Vonleh, Gordon, and Smart. And it's also really weird because the Jazz have a sort of awkward roster situation. Like, it's unclear how committed they are to Enes Kanter, unclear about Alec Burks. Trey Burke was okay his rookie year, but does that like preclude you from taking Marcus Smart? Right. Can Marcus Smart play the two? And then again, yeah, who knows about Enes Kanter? If you want to move Favors to the five and take Gordon or Vonleh or Randall.
It's a really
awkward situation with a lot of choices, but no clear picture coming together.
So, Jacob, if you were at number five, sorry, Ben, to interrupt, but who is the best prospect out of that group of four that you named?
I think it's Vonleh.
Okay,
just
so you're
because
with
of
Ben.
The way the NBA is going, players like him will be prized, and I think he fits a lot better with Favors than do Randall and Gordon.
Yeah.
And while I like Smart a lot more than most people, because of his lack of shooting, I'm less confident in his ability to play the two, and you already have Trey Burke at the one.
Jacob, what do you think of the possibilities that Vonleh may be able to play center in the NBA? Because I actually wrote a piece last year, and I'm still of the opinion very much that Derek Favors, unfortunately, is one of those power forwards who I don't believe can play center. His post defense in the last couple years is evidence of that. When they've played him a lot against centers, I think he's kind of getting killed a lot of the time against them. Do you think, given his extra wingspan, that Vonleh might be a possibility for that, where they could pair those two and not really worry about either one getting abused by a good low post center?
Yeah, you know, I certainly think they could be at least interchangeable, you know, as the three, as the four and the five in a lineup. Vonleh's wingspan is one of his best assets, and that combination of the wingspan and defense plus three-point shooting is like becoming one of the most valuable combinations in NBA today. Just because look at Serge Ibaka, how much of an impact he's made coming back for the Thunder. That shooting, he can provide you spacing plus the rim protection.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is the asset in the NBA right now. And Vonleh provides that.
Do you think he can provide it day one, or do you think it's something that he has to grow into?
He wasn't a super three-point shooter at Indiana, so I don't think it's something he's going to come out there and start knocking down threes like Bosch. But I think it's definitely something that you can grow into. I mean, he only took, I'm not sure exactly how many threes he took at Indiana, but he showed that
just over one a game.
He had the confidence to take them, and you know he's willing to develop taking threes.
He actually, I mean, it was on a really low sample size. It was only a 1.1 attempts per game, but he actually shot 48.5% on the year for this past year. So, I mean, that's way too small of a sample size to judge that he's going to be able to do it over time. But just the fact that he's even up in that range, I think, is certainly a positive, and he's definitely going to have the 18-foot range.
Yeah. Just that willingness, you know, to take it, and then you can leave the Jazz's player development to the rest, just getting him more comfortable there.
Cool. Well, thanks, Jacob. I think Noah, I mean, we talked about him earlier in the show, and I think it does make some sense. I want to do later on the podcast, or later on in future podcasts, I should say, look at kind of Marcus Smart and when Randall and Gordon and those guys, et cetera. So we may have you on again, but thanks again so much for Jacob for joining us all the way from Hawaii again.
Thank you, guys.
All right, so we're running out of time here, but again, another guy who likes Vonleh. So maybe, mm-hmm. I mean, we look at all these different statistical models, but it seems like some of them are at least converging a little bit and liking Noah Vonleh. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get a chance to ask Julius Randle, but doesn't seem to be as big of a fan.
I just don't, for the Jazz's particular needs, I don't see how Randle, unless unless they're really not too confident in Favors, which I don't. I mean, you just extended him last year, and I think at the bare minimum he gets a year or two to see if he's worth this contract number. And I don't see how Randall pairs with him at all. I don't see how those two can play together. Any team that's got a 7 foot tall center, it's over. I mean, you can't guard that guy. And I think, and that could be a question for Vonleh. That's why I asked Jacob that question. Is I think a huge part of that hinges on whether the Jazz or any other team believe that Vonleh is going to be effective as, or at least going to have the potential to be effective as a center. Because I repeat again, I don't think Derek Favors is good playing the five.
So yeah, and I think that's something we have to talk about in the future as well. You wrote an article, and I welcome anyone who's, you know, his question, Derek Favors can play the five. Go ahead and check out your article on Salt City Hoops. And just do a search for Ben Dowsett, Derek Favors, and it'll come up. So anyway, I want to do something every week, and this is maybe the segment of the show I'm most excited about on a week-to-week basis. It is the crazy trade idea of the week. So at the end or somewhere in every show, we're going to throw out a crazy trade idea and kind of look at it, see if it makes sense for both sides. Imagine the future if this crazy trade idea were to take shape, and analyze it and have some fun with it. So, Ben, what is our crazy trade idea of this week?
All right. So my crazy trade idea of this week, I'm basing it all. I'll give some credit. I'm basing it off of an article done, the Downbeat on SLC Dunk yesterday by Peter Novak. A really well done article on looking at the possibilities for if the Jazz were to attempt to trade up in the draft to draft their franchise player. And while it certainly looks, you know, difficult at this point, those four teams all have some needs that may fall into those four players. We're not sure exactly what's going to happen there. I like the possibility if it's there. And so I slightly altered one of the potential, you know, hypothetical trades that Peter brought up in his column. So the trade that I have is the Jazz send the 5th pick, the 23rd pick, the 35th pick, Enes Kanter, and the draft rights to Raul Neto to the Bucks for the 2nd pick, OJ Mayo's contract, and Zaza Pachulia's contract. This is just a slight alteration from Peter's own trade that included Alec Burks.
Okay, so you don't want to include Burks, but let me go over that again. Let me make sure I've got it down. So we've got number 5, mm-hmm. number 23, number 35. So all three of the Jazz's picks this year to Milwaukee, plus Enes Kanter, plus Raul Neto, and anything else, right? I haven't missed anything
else? That's it.
Okay, that's it. So just those five assets.
Just those five.
Literally every pick plus Enes Kanter plus Raul Neto, who, you know, it could be good. It showed some good things in summer league, but you know.
If we could hang on to one of the picks, I'd love it. But because I took Burks out of the deal because I love him and I don't want to trade, and that's just a totally selfish thing. Just to be clear for those listening, I would be okay with the trade of Burks for the right.
Don't tell
the right
them
situation.
That. Milwaukee is listening.
No, I know. I apologize. And I love Alec Burks. I really don't want to see him traded unless it's a perfect situation. But that's why I removed him from my potential
trade. You can't let them know so easily. Milwaukee is listening to this podcast. We represent the Utah Jazz.
It's true.
Alec Burks is gone.
Sorry.
Thanks,
it's true.
Okay, so we give up those three picks plus Kanter plus Neto for what do we get from Milwaukee again?
We get the 2nd pick, and then we take on OJ Mayo's slightly bloated contract, albeit only for one more year, and Zaza Pachulia, it's really not a bloated contract. He's getting paid like $5.2 million or something, and he's not a starting-level player, but he'd be a decent guy for the bench. And he's, again, I think either only one or two more years left on the contract. Neither guy's going to hamstring you long-term, but it does allow Milwaukee to offload probably their two worst contracts. I mean, I don't know how to define bad contracts on that team necessarily. But
yeah, I mean, like Ilyasova and Larry Sanders have kind of questionable contracts.
I guess Sanders is probably the worst contract. We're probably not taking him. I think they're going to give him at least a shot to be worth the money that they signed him to. And, you know, that allows the Jazz to potentially select their franchise player. And as Peter noted in his piece yesterday, and as everyone knows, the Jazz have been, you know, really searching for that franchise player, that defining player who they're going to have going forward. There would potentially be an Embiid or a Parker on the board. And I will say that my personal preference would only be to do a trade like this for one of those two players. I don't know.
Wait,
that
which
I,
one?
My personal preference is Embiid by a good bit.
Okay,
actually.
So if Embiid, let's say draft day comes around and Embiid is taken, do you still do that deal?
I would still probably do it.
Okay, and then who do you draft?
I would draft Parker. Okay. There are a couple concerns. His defense might be a concern down the line. I guess he gained a little weight and the things like that. But, you know, frankly, he's the most ready player right now. If we're talking about it, like we talked with Denham about a rapid improvement, he's going to be the best one for that. And long term, you know, he has all the tools that we're potentially looking at for a franchise player. Plus, you know, people don't like to, you know, make it a big issue, but it certainly may be that he is LDS and he will, you know, be instantly one of the most beloved Utah Jazz players right away.
The marketing dollars will be coming in.
Absolutely. And you know, for a franchise like the Jazz, that is something that you do have to consider, and that can increase a player's value just a little bit.
But so... So that's why you go Parker over kind of the other two guys.
I think he's a better prospect.
Right. I mean, I'm not saying it's just the marketing dollars, mm-hmm. but you know, you've got these other you've got the prospect. But if Embiid's off the board,
if Embiid's off the board, Parker would be my second choice for sure.
So now the Jazz don't have Enes Kanter. So let's say they do get Parker, then you move. Do you play Favors at center? I know that's worrying.
I mean, I guess it's going to partially depend on what Gobert is going to be able to look like next year. Or you play
Zaza Pachulia.
Or you play Zaza. Or, we, like I was saying before, you look into a Spencer Hawes or, if you have enough money around, you could take Pau Gasol for a year. I don't love that, but I'm just saying. Okay. Or, Lopez is probably not happening at that point because our assets are all gone after we make a trade like that. But, there are going to be a few people on the market who you could bring in and, you know, not to disappoint anyone, but even with that, if that were to happen and we were to make that Jabari pick, we're probably not winning the title next season. So we'd have a minute or two to figure something out there in the future. And there's always things you can do there, although you don't want to be too thin at center. It's not the easiest position to fill immediately.
Let's say you take Jabari Parker. Do you also then resign Gordon Hayward?
Oh, man. That's that would depend on the money being thrown at him from elsewhere. If
4 years, 48. $12 million per. Putting you on the spot.
Yeah, you are.
This is not how decisions in the NBA are made, but let's do it.
I know.
Sports Radio.
4 years, 48, and we got to match that. I would do it.
Okay, so then you have a lineup.
That's so close. That's so much. I'd so much rather go 4 years, 40. 4 years, 40. I'm doing it in a second. Which is unrealistic.
Mark Rudelstein says no.
Yeah.
He wants 4-48. So then your starting lineup is Trey Burke, Gordon Hayward, or Alec Burks?
Well, that depends on whether you're planning on starting Jabari at the four or the three.
So first of all, do you think he's a four or a three?
I think he's going to be the type of guy who has the potential to go to both, and that's potentially what maybe makes him a little even more valuable, is that if he's able to keep that strength in his frame, you can rotate him a bit. So whatever works best in a team context, and that'll again probably depend if Gobert in that scenario was ready to step up and play NBA starter minutes. Maybe he plays center, we start Kanter at four, and Jabari plays the three.
But Kanter's traded away.
Or sorry, not Kanter. Oh, I meant Favors. Okay. Sorry. And then I'm probably starting Hayward just because we saw how, despite all my criticisms of it, we saw how effective Burks was coming off the bench last season. He's certainly a good piece there, although I would certainly be messing with the substitution times there so as to get both some time with those starting players.
I just wanted to test you, given your love of Alec Burks. See, and if the Jazz were to do this trade, and I think I would do this trade if I were the Jazz. I don't know if I do if I'm Milwaukee, but I would then go small because that's the way the NBA is going. Yeah. I really do think Jabari Parker makes sense long term as a four, just like Carmelo Anthony does, just like Marvin Williams did. I mean, in my opinion, if you look at a guy who has a question mark between whether or not he's a three or a four, he's usually a four.
Yeah.
And that's just how the spacing and everything works out better. You look at the plus minus numbers, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, and that lineup is going to score on people. You start that lineup, they're definitely scoring
on
some people.
So I go Derek Favors 5, Jabari Parker at the 4, Gordon Hayward, then Alec Burks, Trey Burke.
Yeah, and that, you know, and if I, you know, end up being proved slightly wrong and Favors ends up being able to do some real work against NBA centers, then that could end up being a really strong lineup going forward.
Then you have O.J. Mayo and Zaza Pachulia off the bench, which, you know, they're not terrible players. Well, they were last season, but
Zaza wasn't that bad. Zaza had moments.
Okay, players who had moments.
And Mayo had moments like 3 years ago or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and then you have Rudy Gobert. Raul Neto's gone.
He's gone. Sorry.
You have to find a backup point guard. You've got Deonte Garrett, a backup point guard again. You have, you know, Eric Murphy and Ian Clark, if you want.
Yeah, we did probably have to do a little bit of maybe a splurge or two for a mini mid-level or something like that to find a bench piece. But yeah, you know.
But I like the starting lineup. Okay, so I like imagining this Jazz world. See, this is why we do the crazy
exactly.
Idea of the
this
week,
was fun
because it's fun. Okay, well that's what we're all about here at the Salt City Hoops podcast is fun and math, I guess sometimes
and winning
basketball and winning. Yes. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks again to ESPN 700 Studios for letting us record here. We'll be announcing a new radio show coming up here in a couple of weeks. Keep your eyes out for that. I and also other members of the Salt City Hoops team will be featured on other ESPN 700 shows. So we're really excited about this deal moving forward. Thanks again for listening. Read all of our content at saltcityhoops.com. Thanks again.